Okay, we got down to, we were in section E, last two pieces, E and F, on lesson five, talking about Jesus as the lawgiver. I think in the class last week, Mike had mentioned James 4 as being a fulfillment of this particular prophecy. James, let's just look at James 4:12. Says there is one lawgiver and judge, and one who is able to save and to destroy. So who are you to judge your neighbor? And of course, this is also applicable to the next section, judge. Of course, no question about Jesus and the fact that he brought in a new covenant, a new law. Colossians 2:13 points the point that the old law was nailed to the cross by his death. There's a new covenant that we now enjoy and is in force. I think a verse we may have read before in Hebrews 8 and verse 6. But now he's obtained a more excellent ministry, speaking of Christ, by as much as he is also the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion for a second. And then continues on, excuse me, then with reciting Old Testament prophecy as well, that we have actually, part of which we've looked at one time in the past. And of course, as a result of this new law, this new covenant coming in, we have a new priest, high priest. We looked a little bit at that in the previous lesson. As a result of this new covenant, we are under a new law, a law that's called law of Christ, virtues of law of Christ in Galatians, and also the law of liberty as well in James. Following this law, we have a new mediator of the new covenant, you better state it. It's interesting, John 6:68, which I referred to there, Peter, Jesus, this question comes up to the apostles, are they going to also leave Jesus? And Peter makes this statement, who will we go to? Jesus has the words of life. And the law of liberty and the law, certainly the law of liberty and Christ's law are the law that does have life. Any comments about lawgiver before we move to judge? Briefly. Okay.
So many of these tie in between lawgiver and judge. Matthew 7, beginning of verse 21, many would say in that last day, again, it kind of fits into both categories.
Yeah. And in fact, looking at Christ as the judge, made a point here on this. Even in this prophecy where these offices are combined or these functions are combined, either way you want to call it, you see that. Looking at this to me, is, and we talked about how much evidence there is, the preponderance of evidence to show Christ as being very unique and how he fulfilled these things. And they do overlap. I mean, there's overlap, a lot of overlap in them, if you see them playing out in the New Testament. It's a valid point. Okay, judge for a moment. Don't go to James 4:12. What's the fulfillment? Another one.
When you got your notes there, Robert, John 12:48.
Okay. In fact, really, all of these that I've got there will suffice to support this point. John 12:48, comment that Jesus' words will be that which judges. John 8:16, Christ's judgment is true. 2 Corinthians 5:10 says what? all stands before Christ, the judgment seat. 2 Timothy 4.
Jesus Christ is the judge.
Judge of the living and the dead. Look at Acts. Let's see. What's going on with that? Look at John instead, 5:21. See God's scheme of things. Because does God judge? Does God the Father? Is God the Father a judge? Yeah, of course He is. Has been through time. Just like He's a king. Just like He's a Savior, really. But Jesus has a unique role. John 5:21. Just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life. I want to read all of it. Yeah. Father raises the dead and gives them life. Even so, the Son also gives life to whom He wishes. For not even the Father judges anyone, but He has given all judgment to the Son, so that all will honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. For he who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent Him. Judgment has been given to Christ. He is our judge. And His law will judge us. And that's under the meteorial reign, that word right, of Christ. Such will be the case. So any other comments on that? I think there are half a dozen at least other scriptures you could refer to that talk about Christ being our judge.
You've got actually the last third of Matthew 24 through Matthew 25. That's the three parables, and the parable of the right hand and the left hand. All of those are parables for Christ, and some personification is just.
You know, this goes back to, of course, this is not unique per se with the New Testament, the New Covenant, but this all goes back again to, at least my way of thinking. We are God's creation, and God has the right and has exercised that right to set what the rules are, if you please, for our behavior. And we don't have any trouble with this in terms of nations, national law. The nation makes law. We as citizens of the law should obey the law. We are under law. And when we fail to obey the law, we're called before a judge. And that judge has, by designation of the state, has the right to pass a sentence. Now, we have in this system, of course, a jury, which is a little different. Jury appears. But we don't have any trouble understanding this idea of lawgiver and our need, in the case of citizens, to adhere to the law, whatever that law is. Yeah.
I wrote down John 1:12, talking about Jesus. But as many as received Him, to them He gave the right to become children of God, even though those who believe in His name. He's the one that gives the rights.
By? How?
Because
of
redemptive work.
Yeah. He's got His right to set the rules, but then the rules are set in terms of even how we become His children, right? Through faith and obedience. All right.
Well,
yes.
I have a comment, not specific to particular lessons here, but just overall, so far in class to date. I've observed, and I guess maybe I knew this before, but it really stands out, that when you look at all these prophecies about the Messiah, the lion's share of them come from two books, Psalms and Isaiah. And interesting why those two books, most of them, the Psalms are coming from David, the man after God's own heart. And then Isaiah, kind of interesting why, you know, God had a lot of prophets that could chose to have all the messianic prophecies, but He chose those two. And it's kind of interesting, just kind of observing, it's interesting that Isaiah means salvation of the Lord. You know, it looks like these two men, for some reason, were picked in their writings to have all the messianic. And just an observation that's
maybe just make it easier for us to know where to go. Yeah, who knows? The observation. Okay, prophecies concerning character. I know y'all not heard this. This is a unique idea for me. This idea that words are vehicles on which thoughts travel. And I thought about that when I was putting this lesson together. And really kind of titled it, in effect. There are three terms here that I just call your attention to. One is nature. You might call it prophecies concerning his nature. Second is what I called it, character. Prophecies concerning his character. And the third is prophecies concerning his behavior. Nature, these are definitions, just a dictionary. An essential characteristic and qualities of a person or thing. That's nature. Character, a combination of qualities or features that distinguishes one person, group, or thing from another. And then behavior, of course, is how you conduct yourself, the manner in which one behaves. There's a synonym for the word disposition, but it picks up on these two. But character especially emphasizes moral and ethical qualities. Nature denotes native or inherent qualities. If you understand the terminology nature, nature fits. But unfortunately, in our day and time, nature can often denote something inherent. To me, it is natural to breathe. That's inherent. We don't have control of that. You can sit here and try to stop breathing, and you can't do it. I'll challenge anybody to do it. For the next 5 minutes, stop breathing. And your body won't even let you do it. That's one way of looking at nature. It's natural for us to breathe. But there's another way of looking at nature, and we use this in this kind of terminology. And let's just pick on just. If you say a person is just in character, then he's going to behave in a way that is righteous. And if that's the way he behaves, then we're going to say, well, it's his nature to be just or righteous. Because that's the way he tends to operate. It isn't, in that sense, it's not something that, it is something rather that he has control of. Okay? And that's really what we're talking about here. These are things that Jesus has control of. They are in his nature, but it's because of his character and how he behaved as we go through these. I don't confuse you about interplay the words. The first thing I want to look at is sinless. Isaiah 53:9. And again, we've got a number of passages you can come up with on this one. What did y'all come up with for our fulfillment? Wait a minute, I said we had a bunch of passages.
1 Peter 2,
Luke 23. I've looked at Luke 23, I haven't written down.
What verse are
you? 53.
Well, as it starts,
it's about 50. Starts
where? 50. Okay, and the point being, am I in the right verse? Luke 23, you said, right?
Yes.
Oh, I guess it helps be in the right place.
So he was put in a rich man's tomb.
Sorry?
Because he was put in a rich man's tomb.
Yeah, I think on your lesson, Swally, this is the point I was making earlier, is that there's many different components to all your prophecies. And the one you want us to focus on is the one that's in the pile of sinless. So I started doing that in science. And yeah, there's a lot of them, but which one you want us to look at is the sinless part.
Why is it sinless? Big, bold.
Sorry.
Next time I'm going to highlight them. first time I ever did these classes, I put the prophecy, the field prophecy that I was going to talk about in the right-hand side and then moved up to the altar. I figured out what I was thinking about. Okay, now I'm with you. I was having a hard time connecting. Somebody said 1 Peter 2, that's a good one. Hebrews 4, another good one. Look at John 1:29. We talked about Jesus being a unique individual. And here's this announcement being made, of course, by John in John 1:29. The next day he saw Jesus coming to him and said, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." Unique individual. And who can take away sins? And yet that's exactly what Jesus came to earth to do, to take away the sin of mankind. Hebrews 10, verse 11. Every priest stands daily ministering, offering time after time the same sacrifices which can never take away sins, but he, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time onward until his enemies were made a footstool for his feet. For by one offering he has perfected for all time those who are sanctified. So he came to take away the sin. He was sin of mankind. He was sinless. It was a sinless sacrifice, and it was a one-time sinless sacrifice, and of course the purpose of which was to reconcile us to God. It's interesting, this goes back before this time, when Jesus was transfigured. What was the statement that was made?
I mean, the three tabernacles is what Peter wanted to do.
What did God say?
Peter him.
Okay, back up a word, a sentence.
My beloved son.
It's my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Yes.
Can I ask, I don't mean to detract from the sinless point, but when I see this prophecy, I also see the reason, maybe why he was granted the tomb of the rich. Because the prophecy says, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit found in his mouth. He was sinless. We know that. And from John 19, when he's talking with Pilate in verse 11 and 12, as a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar." So Pilate had a disposition toward Jesus. Jesus didn't utter any threats to Pilate. And, you know, there was no violence in Jesus' trial. And in fact, maybe Pilate perceived him to be a good man. And later in chapter 19 and verse 38, when Joseph came to him, he came to Pilate. And Pilate gave him permission to take him to Pilate. So there may be something in there as well as the reason why he was slave to the rich man.
One thing for sure, I think, and that is, and I make this point, we're going to cover something later on, that is, Pilate's traits may be mentioned. Pilate did not see Jesus as guilty, did he? Jesus is guilty when he's being charged.
That's why he wouldn't make a judgment.
Right. Pilate tried to let him go. And so, those, I call them, in point number, whatever it is, five in this, I call them the uninvolved. That doesn't mean they weren't involved in Jesus's trial and all that. They're uninvolved in the sense that these were not followers of Christ, nor had these been people all along the way for ulterior reasons at the time of trying to pull him down. They hadn't really been involved with Jesus in the past. They were just presented with Jesus in the situation, and they didn't find him to be guilty either. Jesus did not hesitate to expose himself to scrutiny. I'm going to try to guess the average age in here, but we've all been here a few years. And if our lives are put under scrutiny, no matter how good we are, or think we are, certainly are, sooner or later, our lives are put under the kind of scrutiny that Jesus' life was put under, people are going to find us wanting, aren't they? And with Jesus, he welcomed that kind of scrutiny. He challenged people for that kind of scrutiny. Look in Mark 14. In fact, let's hold that. Hold Mark 14 for a minute. Go to John 8 first. Verse 43. Of course, here he's, I think, talking to the Pharisees, if I'm not mistaken. Well, no, the Jewish leaders, we'll just say that, and I'm being specific. He makes a point in 43. Why do you not understand what I'm saying? Is it because you cannot hear my word? You're of your father the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand for the truth, because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I speak the truth, why do you not believe me? Which one of you convicts me of sin? Here it is. He convicts me. And this was Jesus' way. And dropping back to Mark 14:55, says, now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus, to put him to death, and they were not finding any. For many were giving false testimony against him, but their testimony was not consistent. Jesus had people, I mean, in this case, of course we're familiar with it, they would eventually trump up a charge, misrepresenting the fact what he said about his being raised back in destroying the temple. I'm talking about the temple of his body, not the temple, literally, and being able to raise it again. But Jesus did not back off and try to hide under a rock someplace because he was fearful people were going to find fault with him. In fact, they couldn't. They tried. They tried over and over again, and through all the time, they could not succeed. Of course, his apostles, those who lived with him day in and day out, never found fault in him, never reported fault, quite the contrary. And even Judas, after he had concocted his betrayal deal and was successful, what did he do? And on what basis did he do it? Maybe it's more important. He went out and hung himself out of remorse over the fact that, here it is, he had been party to the death of one who, or the betrayal of one, who was innocent. That's the point he made. So this, you know, it doesn't matter which direction you look in, whether it be his enemies, his friends, those who really don't care one way or the other, none of them ever found fault in Jesus. And, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if that's what would be said of us, but it can't be. That's why Jesus is such a blessing to us.
I find that very interesting that in Luke 23, it's about the trial again before Pilate. Right. And, you know, the Pharisees and the scribes and the leaders are there, and they make the accusations against Jesus. But, I mean, they couldn't bring up anything to prove to Pilate. And here is a not interested, like we said, you know, judge. And he sees the ridiculousness of it. And there's just no proof. And so, you know, and then he turns to Jesus and asks him. And so, and he believes Jesus over these Jews.
Yeah, and one thing for us to keep in mind, I want to be accused of going too far on this. Pilate, Herod, they had a limited view, didn't they? Their response is to a limited amount of data. But you have Jesus out in the field 3 years. Being exposed to challenge after challenge after challenge, and walking on the earth to be observed by people who were trying to find fault with him that whole time, and they weren't successful. So it didn't make a difference where you turn. Even those who had a desire to do it couldn't do it. Okay. Say, Mike.
Well,
initially the scriptures bring out that the leadership of Judas, Jesus, Jesus' teaching because of, you know, what he did on the Sabbath day, that he claimed to be as a, you know, a God in heaven. But here in the end, and like you were bringing up Mark 14, John's account of that in chapter 18, you know, where the high priest would question Jesus about his disciples and his teaching, Jesus said to him in verse 20, he says, I've spoken openly to the world, I've always taught the synagogue and the temple, and Jews come together and said, it's a secret. You know, you've had all this time to come and ask me, you know, about my teaching. Of course, they did ask me in tricks and such as that. But not in a serious manner. But, you know, there's a parallel we've got between going now in our political scene. They didn't ask Jesus at this time about these things they asked him about before, but it made it such an issue. Is it because they've learned in the meantime that, you know, they weren't real issues? What is it they've learned? You know, I don't know. But, you know, we've got some politics, not to get into that, they kind of follow that same scene. I mean, the political side's kind of humorous.
Yeah.
But this concerning him, they had these opportunities. You know, it's serious. Who are you? But, you know, they never approached him as serious. We wouldn't learn that.
I heard something today that fit that statement in my way of hands at the T about politics. It was, when you're campaigning, you make 80% of the campaign directed at your opponent, 20% on your policies or issues. So you attack the opponent. That's what you do in politics. You know, remember John 11:48? Jews were afraid of losing their power, having it taken away from them. They were operating on the politics, period. There's no two ways around that. And those who were after truth would find truth. Jesus assured them that. Okay, holy. Move to holy. Psalms 16:10. Now, this is an easy one. Where do you find fulfillment of this? Early on. Say early on after his resurrection. Acts 2. As Peter's making his argument there in Acts 2, he quotes this. And so, you know, again, we point out the apostles use the Old Testament, tied back to it, particularly when they're talking to the Jews, tie back to it to make their case. They say, to be able to show that the Jews did believe in prophecy, whether they interpreted it right or not, they believed it was inspired. And so you have the apostles just marking back to show this is that. And of course, in Jesus' case, this had not been, in terms of how this carried on, this had not been something that was a hidden secret. Made the point in Luke 1:35, Gabriel, when he was announcing the birth of Jesus, called him this. When Jesus would, and I didn't use the terminology holy, but when Jesus would discharge the demons, unclean spirits, you know, they knew who they were dealing with. They knew that this was not just a man, this was the Son of Man. They had no problem recognizing Jesus as the Son of Man. His apostles certainly, we mentioned in Acts 2, recognized it, used this scripture. Go to Acts 3, verse 14. It says, but you disown, again here, Peter was in a sermon, but you disown the Holy and Righteous One, and ask for murder to be granted to you. So again, Peter, in his sermon, makes this point about the uniqueness of this individual being holy. Holy means what, by the way?
Set apart.
Really, set apart, consecrate. It carries, of course, in religious ideas, being separated from sin. not simply, you and I might be consecrated to something, but in Jesus' case, and generally the word holy means also separated from sin, certainly.
Are the ones set apart to make holy?
Can be.
Yeah, you know, that's when we're talking about announcement of Jesus and all those kinds of things. It was God's person that He sent to make holy.
Right. In Jewish idioms, that's common. It plays two ways. It can play, this is what He is, and this is what He will cause to happen. It can be interpreted both ways. Sometimes it means both, as a matter of fact. Okay? Certainly, as we just read, as apostles acknowledged this, the fact that this was the Holy One, being identified that way. He used the same argument later, Paul does, when he's talking to the Jews in Pisidia, Antioch of Pisidia. Talks about Jesus as the Holy and Righteous One, or the Holy One as well. So as Jesus is described throughout the Scriptures, you'll see this not this adjective applied to Him, or if you prefer, in a way, a state of who He was. You waving at me, or you got it?
So the points we just been making about this one, we put this under character. You could actually more put under office or mission, couldn't you?
I suppose you could, in a sense. You mean in a sense of making us holy?
No, in the sense that, you know, that their songs, he is the Holy One. They're Luke 1. Well, what does that mean?
As so like he's a priest, like he's a king, like he's a holy a holy one?
Yeah.
You could. That would not be my preferred, but you could.
It's just like that phrase we're so common with, we find in Leviticus and also 1 Peter, be holy for I am holy. So be holy, talking to us, be holy, be set apart. It says, for I am holy. You go back in Leviticus and you look at that word, holy could be set apart, but also there's an implication, could be the Holy One. And back in Leviticus, he's trying to convince the people, I am Lord, so you be holy, for I am holy. I think there's an implied, I am the Holy One. I am the Lord.
Yeah, not to be argumentative, but the when I think of offices, these are offices that conduct something like prophet, priest, king. We associate with that.
Yeah.
You can have a righteous king or unrighteous king. You can have a holy king or an unholy king. Holy is an adjective as opposed to a... Well, it is an adjective. Now, you apply one to it, the Holy One, you can argue the point that, you know, this is what he is. This is his designation, if you like. And, you know, no quibble.
There in Acts 13:35, the note on the side there, to allow the Holy One, is literally about the pious.
Yeah.
And so this, evidently, going back to Psalm 16, is talking about it looks like, or not character, but, you know, describes.
Again, these are two, devout and pious are two adjectives. Adjectives, in this case, the name of nature, they're two adjectives. It can apply to us, holy ones. We can be holy. Should be holy. Okay. You like that? Let's talk about just. Just is, if you look in the King James Version, that's word typically be translated just. You probably already figured this out. What is it? How's it translated generally in the New American Standard? For those of you who have that, for everybody except Sally, righteous is the common word, and that's what it notes: a state of being right or right contact. By conduct, really. And so Zechariah, we've been to Zechariah 9:9 before, and we just read Acts 3:14. Obviously, that's a fulfillment. holy and righteous one. Holy one and righteous, or the holy one and the just, as it is, I think, in the New King James. Term frequently used of God. I gave you a couple of verses for that. Christ also used the John. Look at John 5.
John
5:30. Says, I can do nothing of my own initiative. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of him who sent me. Christ himself used that term of himself in terms of this passage in John 5. Stephen in Acts 7:52 also refers to Christ in this way, talking about their fathers, if he was challenging them, your fathers who killed the prophets who announced the coming of the righteous one. And so the idea, the tying of the Messiah with the holy, as we talked about, and righteous one, which again, this speaks to a very unique character. Who can be said to be righteous of their own being? And goes hand in hand with the idea of being, we've already talked about it, being sinless. 1 Peter 3:18. Look at. It says, for Christ also died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust, so that he might bring us to God, having been put to death. Christ's character, the fact that he was sinless, in this case the argument made because he was righteous, could fulfill the role that was given to me. And Peter's argument, of course, what sense would it make for those who are like us, the unrighteous, dying for the unrighteous? That happens all, by the way, that happens all the time. Not in the scope of Jesus, but people give their lives all the time for other people. That's not unusual. So it goes beyond that. And here, of course, it's dealing with the nature of this individual who sacrifice himself for you and me. We have no trouble seeing which side of the equation we belong on, and that is the unjust. Unfortunately, we had one who was just, one who was righteous, to close that gap. Okay, anything on that before we move to zealous?
Just a quick question, we won't get into it too much. You know, when I was reading the Deuteronomy 32:4, passage there on, you said a term used of God, the rock there. Is that not God the Son used back then during that time?
It doesn't, I mean, even if it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's God.
God. And you're going to find that.
Because, you know, it's talked about the rock of Christ in the New Testament, going back to the rock of the living water.
And I don't know. I'm not sure. Okay. In all cases, it's like when God's used, the term God's used. I'm not always, you know, there are times I can't. It's smarter than me to figure out which God is being spoken of, which person is the God that's been spoken of here.
2 Thessalonians 1 also points out the righteousness in dealing out retribution, that Jesus is going to come with his angels and deal out retribution to those who persecute.
Yeah, when we think of justice, I think, when I think about that, I think of justice and justice. And of course, the other side of that equation is, I don't want justice. I want mercy. And that's just, you know, where we are. Thankfully, we have mercy, and God showed mercy in our case by Christ coming. Okay, zealous. Psalm 69:9. What'd you give her for fulfillment on this?
John 2:17, maybe.
Maybe
it's Luke 2:49.
Maybe Luke 2:49. I wrote that one. same thing. Well, maybe Luke, oh, I don't know why I keep wanting to go to that book. I had a hard time finding Luke 2 there.
Luke
2, 49. 49? I'm getting there. Okay.
The problem I have with John 2 is I don't understand. I don't know, because it says here in verse 17, his disciples were members that it was written. Now, are they talking about the zealousness that Jesus is throwing out the money changers, or are they talking about the zealousness of the money changers trying to, you know, profit?
I think it's the former. The connection I would make is that may be the incident this is describing. I shall offer an alternative. Certainly the other will fit. You know, you see, the zeal of thine house has eaten me up, and the reproaches of them that reproach thee have fallen on me. In fact, look at Mark 11 for a minute. Let's stick with the idea that fulfillment is, for just a moment, quick moment, the fulfillment is this incident. Look at Mark 11, verse 15. Starting in verse 15, here's the driving out, etc. Jump to verse 18. The chief priests and scribes heard this and began seeking how to destroy him, for they were afraid of him, for the whole crowd was astonished at his teaching. In other words, he threw them out, and the scribes, the leaders, were on his case. Okay? Which would fit with the rest of this psalm verse. However, I suggest this alternate to you. That the spirit, the house being spoken of here in Psalm 69, which is clearly messianic, is one of the spiritual house of Israel. And the zeal that goes along with that, you can see all throughout Christ's presence on the earth. I'll give them to you real quick. John 4:34, for example, he says, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and accomplish his work." John 9, "We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no man can work." Luke 2:49, "Why is it that you were looking for me? Do you not know that I had to be in my Father's house?" Written down, couldn't remember it. So there's just example after example after example on this. And that's a description of the zealousness that Jesus had for God's spiritual house. What was the outcome of that? Crucifixion. Trial and crucifixion. And so I suggest to you that may very well be what's really being looked at here in 69 as opposed to this single event. But the disciples recognized this before they really recognized this connection.
That was
before it was really in. Yeah, that's a fair point.
To be messianic. Christ never gave credence to that interpretation.
Right.
That's the title.